I don't know. The whole point of this is to tell some more stories here. So,
yeah.
So your latest episode of Mention and Dispatches, we're going to have some background noise at this one because we have with us Jim Werbeneth. Howdy, Jim.
Hi.
And yeah, we're waving at the computer as though you guys can actually see us on the audio here. But you are going to have some background noise because we are coming to you yet again from Gamers Armory. I say again, this is the first time I mentioned Dispatches has been at Gamers Armory. Although back at a previous podcast to remain unnamed, Jim and I did an episode from here before. And there was a game night going on there too. There's pretty much a game night here. Look, we're going to sound like complete shills for Scott's store, and there's a reason for that. It's because it's a flippin' awesome store, and he's not paying us to do this. He's not even here, even though we invited him to join us on this. But when you get a good wargame heavy store, you should totally extol their virtues. And tonight's actually Minnie's night in here, so we've got some Malifaux, we've got some Hordes. What else we got over there? War Machines going on. There's some BattleTech stuff happening. Yeah, I'm eyeing the tables across the way here, trying to figure out exactly what they got going on. Unfortunately, we can't walk around with the laptop that we're recording on because the battery is shot, and if I unplug it from the wall, it'll die in like 2 minutes. So I can bring the laptop here with us to record. We just can't walk around with it. So, all right, Jim, you've got the bag here. What's in the bag?
Well, before we even started, I do support the store show again. I bought Roads to Gettysburg 2, Lee Strikes North, which combines two great battles of the American Civil War games, plus a little more. It's Here Come the Rebels and Roads to Gettysburg combined.
All right.
And one nice edition package. And to continue my American Civil War trend, to take Washington, Jubal Early's Summer 1864 campaign from MMP, designed by our friend Dean Essing.
Yeah, so we got a pair of MMP games here. And still in the shrink. Not going to ask him to crack the shrink here because he's probably going to do some unboxing for it later at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, before I'd even walked in the door, Jim's plunking down $200 worth of games here.
Yeah.
And
because I'm totally broke, but I still got more money than sense.
Yes. Yes. Well, the one of the cool things Scott does, and I'll be honest, I have no idea if he does this for mail order people or not, but if you do spend $150 here at the store, you get a $10 discount for the next time you come pick something up here. So Jim split his purchase in half in order to use the $10 off he got from the first purchase to help bring down the cost of the second.
Works for me.
I'm sure I have redeemed at least a half a dozen, if not more, of those $10 off coupons around here in the almost 10 years that Scott's had the store. So the unfortunate part about not being able to walk around is we can't, like, walk around and do sort of a tour. On this rack, we've got these things, you know. Probably should have taken some cell phone pictures before we started recording this.
Well, the unfortunate thing for me is I live 550 miles away, so my time in this store is precious.
Yeah.
But it is one of my favorite game stores.
Yeah. And so, the way Scott has things laid out in here, he's got a row of all the racks are all mobile wire racks, so he can just sort of pop the wheels up and reconfigure the store at the drop of a hat if he needs to move things out of the way. The front half of the store is all game stuff. The back half is all game tables. But he's got two rows of racks up front. One of them is Euro games, kids games, family games, puzzles, card games, that kind of stuff. The second row back is almost all war games. There's a couple of role-playing kinds of things. Some of the, like, the role-playing minis games, so like the D&D minis kind of stuff, some of the Pathfinder minis. But after that, it's chronological order, working your way up from the ancients over to the modern day. And so we got Command and Colors Ancients on there. Around one side's the American Revolution stuff, Age of Gunpowder stuff, Napoleonic Wars, and you get up into the American Civil War, which I think might be an entire rack by itself on both sides.
Crap ton of temptation.
Yes. Crap ton of World War II stuff, a handful of modern things, and then some of the war mini stuff down at the end with a lot of Team Yankee stuff, a lot of Flames of War stuff. None of those racks are the ASL stuff. We'll post a picture of it with this podcast, but there is the wall of ASL, and it is a wall.
It is impressive.
I'm eyeing it from across the room here, and we'd have to put an account. There is easily 200 separate, distinct items for sale over there. Now, there's three or four copies of some of them, But there's easily 200 different pieces of ASL stuff on those racks over there that you can pick up and buy and walk out of here with, including some stuff that's pretty hard to find from other people, from some third-party vendors and such. We hadn't even gotten into the minis. We haven't even gotten into the collectible cards or the opposite wall that's got all the role-playing stuff up on the racks. But yeah, as far as wargame-friendly stores go, when you've got a dude running the store that started his business doing ASL mail order, that's something worth, you know, supporting and hanging out with. And, it's a great store to come chill with. All right, so American Civil War stuff. Look, I'm not an American Civil War gamer. It's not just because I'm from the South and we lost. It's the period just doesn't hold a ton of interest to me. But obviously it does for you because you're walking out of here with, you know, $200 worth of ACW games here. So give us your thumb. What's the fascination with the American Civil War for you?
Well, it's one of the first things that I ever got interested in as a very young kid. I saw a Civil War reenactment. Believe it or not, it was an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies. And when I was six, as well, my dad took me to Gettysburg the first time. So my original interests were in World War II, which was one that my dad and my uncle had served in, and Civil War because of that early exposure. In fact, it has stayed with me so much. I have lost count how many times I've been to Antietam and Gettysburg. I've been to most of the battlefields in the Eastern Theater. And I came very close to doing a course concentration, the Civil War, when I got my master's in military history. And I did pick Second World War. But one of my favorite courses there was an elective on command strategy and leadership in the Civil War.
You're also commuting distance to Gettysburg where you live, right?
So I'm about 4 hours from Gettysburg, okay. About 4 hours from Antietam and Harper's Ferry.
Okay, I thought you were a little closer to Gettysburg.
I can actually drive up and back on the same day to Antietam and Harper's Ferry.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah,
and you know, of course, here in North Carolina, we've got Guilford Courthouse that's not that far away.
Yeah.
And then you can go over to Bennett Place over in Durham, which is where they actually surrendered the Carolinas to Sherman's army as it was burning its way through the South there.
In fact, just yesterday, I was down at Fort Fisher. It was closed because it's, well, a Monday, so I went to the aquarium. But I've been to Fort Fisher a couple times. I've been to Bentonville. Guilford Courthouse is one of my favorite Revolutionary War battlefields. Yeah. And of course, I've been to the USS North Carolina four or five times so far.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that Guilford Courthouse is a Civil War battle.
Right.
It's just one of the battlefields.
Really
it's just one of the battlefields that we've got in range here. So
yeah.
There's not a ton of them around here.
No.
So.
And we don't have a ton of Revolutionary War stuff around me, so I take the opportunity.
You got Fort Pitt.
Well, that's more French and Indian
that's
War.
That's pre-revolutionary.
Yeah, we've got some French and Indian War stuff. In fact, I used to work across the street from the Battle of Grant's Hill before they tore down the hill. Grant Street in downtown Pittsburgh. I've been throughout most of the battlefields for the French and Indian War as well, both in the United States and Canada. So anytime I go on vacation, it's going to be a battlefield nerve fest.
There's a battlefield there somewhere, yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the great things about living in Europe, right? You just trip over them.
No, I mean, you can't swing a cat without hitting a battlefield from some era or some fort.
We were in there was one year that my wife and I went over to Scotland. I did 4 years of undergrad and then 2 years of my master's program and then 4 years in the PhD program that I never got around to finishing. And so that adds up to like 10 different spring breaks. And all of those spring breaks, I went south once. And that was the year spring break lined up with Mardi Gras. Every other year for spring break, I either stayed home, went laterally, or went north. I clearly had no idea how to do spring break, right? I went to Boston 1 year. We went to Toronto 1 year. 1 year for spring break. It was right around my wife's birthday. We had worked out some arrangements with parents to keep our son. And we flew to Scotland. And we hung out in Scotland. And it was a surprise for my wife. So, you know, that was fun. But we went up to Stirling Castle.
Oh, cool.
And from Stirling Castle, you can see, just walking around the walls of Stirling Castle, you can look down into the valleys there and see like five different battlefields. It's incredible. Because you got, I think it's Bannockburn is right there in view. There's the Battle of Something Other Bridge. I keep wanting to say Stamford Bridge.
That was a little further south.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was
well, but the reason Stamford Bridge sounds wrong to me is that that's also the stadium in which Chelsea plays their soccer games.
Yes.
And that's down in London, and you can't see London from Stirling Castle.
No, not quite.
But I can't remember all the battlefields off the top of my head, but from Stirling Castle, you can see four or five different battlefields. There's markers up on the walls. If you look here, that grove of trees is where this battle was fought in, 1011 or whatever, pick a year from way back when.
Yeah.
And you can see them all from there. That castle also has the museum for the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, which is kind of cool.
That would be cool.
Yeah. So yeah, you're tripping over battlefields everywhere. It's kind of like Tidewater, Virginia. You're tripping over battlefields everywhere. Here in North Carolina, Bennett Place wasn't much of a battle, right? It was surrender or I'm going to set the town on fire. So, Johnston kind of laid down his arms.
He was good at that.
Yeah.
That and retreating.
Yes. Yeah. That's because he could do math.
Yeah.
He's sort of, there's more of them than there are of us. We shouldn't stand here.
Well, Bentonville, he did attack, and that was sort of like seeing a bunny rabbit turn on a pack of wolves.
Yeah. Well, he was trying to buy some time.
Yeah.
So clearly you got a personal tie to some of the Civil War stuff. Mm-hmm. Favorite Civil War game. Can you pick one? Is there one out there that really sticks out as?
Thunder at the Crossroads from the original version from the Gamers.
Okay.
That's my favorite Gettysburg game. I don't think it's ever gotten any better than that. and I love that system, hence buying the successor system to take Washington.
Okay.
But that's one of my favorite Civil War systems, and I think that is the best game on Gettysburg.
So is it just Gettysburg, or does it include the approach battle also?
The original did not. It was just Gettysburg.
It's just so everybody's already sitting there staring at each other across the field.
Yeah, General Heath is looking for shiz, and the fun starts.
Yep. I've long noted that part of my problem with refighting Gettysburg the way you refight Gettysburg is that if you were going to refight Gettysburg, you wouldn't fight it there.
No.
Right? That's part of the problem is that everybody sort of stumbled into that fight.
Yeah.
And if you were going to make a, if you were going to have a decisive turning point sort of battle, you especially if you're on Lee's side, you probably would have picked somewhere else to do this.
Absolutely. In fact, Lee had told Heath not to start the battle without him, but of course he does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Harry Heath kind of thought he could do what he wanted. And we saw how that one worked out. But to me, it's fascinating because the first day is a classic meeting engagement. Then it becomes a series of assaults.
Yeah.
And then you have a non-pursuit afterward because, well, we still fight about this, but the Union was so completely disorganized that I don't personally think a pursuit was practical.
Yeah. There is an art to pursuing things that's not just, come on, boys, run them down.
Yeah.
There's a little more to it than just that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but that has long been my favorite, and that's about 4.5 hours from me.
Yeah.
Yeah. First one I went to when I was six.
The real battle, not the game.
Real battle.
So have you ever taken the map with you to the battlefield and tried
not
to
the game map, but not I've taken plenty of historical maps.
Well,
over
yeah.
The years.
Everybody's taking the historical map to the battlefield.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've taken the game map with you to the battlefield.
That I haven't done. I believe the last time I took my girlfriend who did not want to hold the map.
There you go.
Yeah.
So
there's plenty hot for. Every time I go to Gettysburg, unless it's February, it's broiling hot, even by North Carolina standards.
Well, are you going for the commemoration of the battle? I mean, July in the States is usually a little toasty.
I would love to sometime.
Yeah.
But I think my schedule's pretty well taken care of for 4th of July.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Do you remember what you picked up last time you were here, since you got Civil War stuff this time?
I think I bought the 1866 game from Compass.
Okay.
And I want to say I got the Reluctant Enemies again from MMP.
Okay.
That's why I want to say I bought, but I lose track. I've got a compulsion.
After a while, they all blend together.
Yeah.
So
I've got a compulsion, and I'm not changing.
Yes. Yes. after a while, they do sort of blend together. One of the things, again, you know, look, you've got Line of Departure. I've got Armchair Dragoons. Before that, you know, worked other sites, both Wargamer and Grogheads. And so we're always getting stuff sent to us. So there's a limit to how much we're actually going to spend money on. So if we're buying games, it's because we really like the game and or really like the store we're buying it from. So
yes.
One of the things that I've picked up quite a bit here over the years is I picked up a bunch of the Euro games and family games to sit down and play with the kids, including some Christmas presents. So, you know, we picked up Monster Factory for my daughter for Christmas here one year. It's a tile-laying game, so it's sort of Carcassonne-ish that you're connecting things, but you're building monsters. What kid doesn't love monsters, right? Yeah, tentacles, wings, giant eyeballs, all kinds of stuff.
Show me a little kid who doesn't like monsters and doesn't like dinosaurs. I will show you a problem that's growing up.
Yes, yeah, no kidding. I picked up Seven Wonders Armada here when that came out, so I'm feeding my Seven Wonders addiction.
Yeah.
At some point, I'm going to come back here and get the Pantheon expansion for Seven Wonders Duel, which is the two-player version of Seven Wonders. At some point, I'm picking up war games here as well and have over the years a couple of times. So it's just been a while. So I'm trying to think off the top of my head what the last war game I picked up here was. It's been a while. So
you're more sensible than I am.
Yeah, well, barely.
Yeah.
It's not like I don't spend money here. I'm just not spending it on war games because, again, a lot of times I'm getting review copies sent to me.
Yes.
And getting some copy cranked out on those things. And so, you know, the stack of stuff that I've got at home of things people have sent me. Well, quite frankly, look, this isn't going to come as a revelation to anyone who's listened to any podcast that I've been on recently. I'm not as bad as Mirth. I've still got stuff in shrink from 3 origins ago where I saw it. I'm like, oh, that'd be really cool. Picked it up. It's still in shrink. It's in a stack of games. Now, I have 2 or 3 that are still in shrink that people gave me.
Yeah.
I don't really count those because somebody gave them to me. It's not like I went out and bought them and said, oh, I really want to play this. I've got stuff I bought because I really wanted to play. This is still in shrink 3 years later.
Yeah. Well, I'm sort of in the same way, but I'm lucky. I have one friend named Walt Dipple. He and I exchange war games for Christmas and also for birthdays.
There you go.
And he has really good taste in games, and I analyzed some of them in Line of Departure over the years.
Did you ever get one back that you had previously gifted him?
No, we have never regifted each other, but sometimes we will give each other a game that the other one has just bought, or my girlfriend has given me.
Yeah.
I love my girlfriend. She feeds my nerd addiction.
There are worse kinds of girlfriends to have than
absolutely
feed the nerd addiction.
And she understands why I have an overgrown game library and an overgrown book library.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, I've sort of lost control of my book library at my place because it's downstairs. We've got a big downstairs rec room kind of thing. Tons of built-in bookshelves and my son's Xbox, which means I can't ever get down there.
Yeah.
He's either blowing stuff up in the Division II or, you know, pummeling some hapless opponent in a FIFA game.
Yeah.
My son's actually a really good real life soccer player, not just a video game soccer player, but he does hoard the downstairs a little bit for the end. For his ex, on the plus side, he's downstairs. Like, he's contained. We know where he is.
Yeah.
We can find him when we need him. And he's not in the way of everything else we're doing around the house, but it would still be nice to be able to use my library with my fireplace every once in a while.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's a sort of situation I'm in, except I'm usually by myself. But when I've got the girlfriend and the dog there, I have to share the space.
Yeah.
Not that I mind.
Yeah,
I love
well.
Them both. My whole house is basically my man cave now. In fact, my real estate guy, the late Harry Anderson, that was his real name, he took one look at my library and said, we have to get Jim a house based on this.
Yeah.
He actually showed me houses based around my war games, especially.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
One of these days, once the kids are out of the house, I've always said what I would really like to get for both my war game library and, I was addicted to National Geographic for many, many years because the maps that came with them for my National Geographic map library.
Yeah.
I want to get one of the old school big map cabinets where you can lay them all out flat, store them all flat, have the drawers that you pull in and out. Now, I've got the space downstairs once the kids are out and I get the toys and everything else out of there. I'll have the space down there to do that. Don't right now. An exercise bike in the way as well. But one of these days I would like to have the map cabinet down there with sort of the drafting table top. Now, I know that that's totally impractical for being able to play games on because it's a tilted surface.
Yeah.
I get that. But to be able to display a map on, I would and like a Rick Barber map. Who the hell doesn't want to display a Rick Barber
map? Art.
I know. Yeah. So, you know, frame a Rick Barber map and hang it up. Yeah. But that's what I would like to eventually be able to get is the map cabinet where I can lay all the maps out flat, leave them flat, be able to pull them out as needed and throw them at, because I've got the National Geographic maps. I've got a ton of war game maps. I've got a handful of war game maps that I've worked on over the years. I've also got still a ton of 1 over 50K military maps from my time in service and other things along the way. Somewhere along the way, I'm still not sure how we got them. We've got a bunch of air traffic control maps around the house as well. I think we picked them up when my son was at Cub Scouts and somebody was giving them out at Cub Scouts something. Still got them. No idea what I'd use them for, but they look really cool. So, you know, maybe I just need to wallpaper the room with maps.
I've seen worse.
Yeah, well. Probably done worse.
Yeah. Fifth, I take the fifth.
Yeah. Slight preview here. This podcast will be out a couple of weeks after we record this, but still in plenty of time for folks looking forward to Origins. Jim is actually joining us at Origins this year, and he's going to be one of our featured speakers in the Armchair Dragoons program at the Origins War College. And so, you know, the War College over the years kind of got absorbed into the larger Origins University, which for folks that have been around the War College for a long time, we all agree that was a mistake. We all understand why it happened. We still think it's a mistake. But when the Armchair Dragoons started doing stuff, and before, you know, under the Grockhead's name, but Armchair Dragoons now, when we started doing stuff with Origins, one of the things we made it a point to want to do was reintegrate with the War College to bring some of the gaming back in there, and also to help them beef up their speaker session, because a bunch of their speakers were now working with us. We drafted Jim to help fill out some of that speaker program. So you've got six talks.
I think four talks at the moment.
Four talks in 6 hours, I think is what it works out to. So I know one of them is the, so you want to design a war game talk.
Yes.
We'll come back around to that one here in a second. The other three are historical talks though, right? What do we got coming up?
Well, as I recall, I had a set of talks that we sort of narrowed it down to. One of my favorites is going to be the logistical foundations of the Overland campaign in 1864. And it's going to touch as well on Ulysses S. Grant's mastery of logistics, which is one of the things, sorry, Southerners, but I think that he was way better than Lee in that regard.
Yeah.
That he made some essential decisions there that dictated the course of the campaign and had a cost in going through the wilderness, but was actually very far-seeing in his ability to use combined operations and work with the Navy for his logistics, which other generals, with the possible exception of McClellan in the Peninsula, often did not do.
Yeah.
That's a big one for me.
Yeah.
I believe I'm also going to do one on Lord Cornwallis in the American Revolution.
Okay.
Whom I do not regard as a hapless loser, as American history has pointed him, but actually a very competent soldier, politician, and diplomat who had a very serviceable career through his entire time with the British Army as a diplomat, as I mentioned, a member of Parliament, and someone who actually sympathized with the Americans.
Yeah.
And it was a whole lot more than Yorktown.
Yeah. Well, he got pinned in a corner of Yorktown through a series of bad circumstances.
Yes.
And when the French ran off the British fleet, he was stuck.
Yes.
And there's no getting unstuck at that point. If you've ever been to Yorktown, you know you're stuck.
Yes. And there are worse things that a British general can do than rely on the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the
especially
Royal
at
Navy,
that time.
Yeah. The Royal Navy did not live up to its hype on that day.
Well, I mean, the Royal Navy lost, like, what, 5 battles to the French in 200 years? That just happened to be one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. The one that mattered.
Yeah. The one we really needed.
Yes.
So we've got Grant talking some logistics, overland campaigns, American Civil War stuff. We've got Cornwallis at Yorktown, and do you remember what the other one was? I don't either because I don't have the schedule right in front of me. But
I've got them all written out. I've got the PowerPoints because I've been developing these things for years.
Yeah.
I remember too. I did do a presentation before. This may be on the schedule, but the 77th Infantry Division in World War II.
It might be a World War II one in there somewhere. We were trying to spread them around historically to help cover a variety of topics.
Yeah.
I know we've got Jim and Doug are going to be talking some about the appropriate level for simulating combat in the Age of Gunpowder, maybe Age of Region. I'm going to be talking Fog of War. I did Civilians on the Battlefield last time. I think I got Fog of War coming up this year. We've got the guys from On Target Sims going to be giving an update on sort of their development of their newest World War III, Cold War Goes Hot in Europe game. They're the guys that do the Flashpoint Campaigns game that we use for all of our CPXs at the show. But they've got an expansion to that coming out that they're going to be talking about, sort of what's going on with that. It's been in development for 7-8 years at this point, so it's getting closer and closer to imminent.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sunday morning, we've got the big Wargaming Media Roundtable, which we've never done this before. So we're gonna take a swing at it and see what happens. We're going to get all the different Wargame media folks. So Jim's going to be there. I'm going to be there. We're hoping Katie Adley's still going to be able to make it. A couple of the guys online from places like Wargame HQ, a couple other folks that are going to be at the show. We're going to try and get all those guys to show up. And we're going to have a open roundtable for the audience to come talk to us about what do you like, what do you don't like, about what we're covering, how we do it. Come talk to the Wargame media folks and let us know what we can do better for you. And we're going to talk a little about sort of how we do things and some of the decisions we make. Which, let's face it, look, you've been a content editor dude. I've been a content editor dude. You'd be amazed at how much of what we end up publishing comes down to, well, this guy turned it in on time.
Yes.
I'm not sitting around waiting for it for somebody else. So we're going to run with what we got.
Yeah. It's like you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. We do the same thing with our magazines.
Yes. You go to press with the articles you've got.
Yes. And in my case, my issue is, what articles have I written? Because it's usually just me.
Yeah, well.
But, yeah, it's sometimes if you have a surplus you can really work with, you're doing very, very well and can cover yourself fortunate.
Yes. Yeah, it does happen very often.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so we're gonna talk a little about that on Sunday morning once most of the gaming has actually wrapped up. And we're going to have a little fun with that. One of the things we are going to try to do is we're going to try and stream as many of the talks as possible through either Twitter or Facebook. We're going to try and video stream, live stream as much as we possibly can. Actually, we've got a YouTube channel set up now. Maybe we'll end up running it through YouTube. I don't know.
Oh, that would be cool.
Somehow, some way, we're going to get these suckers at least recorded for later publication. But if we can stream them, we're going to try and stream as much as we can to show this year. And that's, let's say, that's one of the things we try to do with Armchair Dragoons as much as possible, is get away from just, you know, articles here and there, and we're trying to get away from just taking unboxing photos of games. Like, if we're going to open up a game, we're going to give you a little more commentary about it than just that. But we've got the Saturday night streaming that we do with the Saturday night fights, where we've got tabletop simulator games that are running for a couple hours. But at the show, we want to stream as much as possible. We want you guys to feel like you're there and involved and a part of the gaming, even if you're not. And if you're not, you damn well should be.
Yes.
So, at some point, we're roping you into one of the CPXs. You know that, right?
What's a CPX? It's Please explain for the audience.
It's the Command Post Exercises. It's been through several names over the years. We originally, it was just the Staff Wargaming, and that was a really shitty name, right? Let's face it. Who the hell wants to do Staff Wargaming? That sounds like work. Well, it's kind of work, but it's fun work. Then we started calling them the Command Post Wargames, except then Marshall Barrington showed up with the company that does Command Post Wargames. We're like, well, shit, we have to change. But CPX is short for Command Post Exercise. It's a military term, and it's when the command post itself does their sort of training stuff. And that's really what we're doing. And so we give you a short primer on the military decision-making process, sort of teach you how a staff builds an order, and then we give everybody their different roles, the commander, the XO, the ops guy, the log guy, the fires guy, the intel guy, and we hand you the mission, and we go, all right, in a half an hour, we're going to start, go put your orders together. And so you guys are all playing it cooperatively. Everybody's on, you know, one team together. And so the commander's got to specify what's supposed to happen, and then we plug everything into the system. We do use a computer for the adjudication. And so it's cool because we use Flashpoint Campaigns, and we have the developers of Flashpoint Campaigns on our team, so they kind of know how to run the game. When you write the code for it, you know how to run it. And so they'll hit turn one and say go, and then when your entire plan goes to crap on the end of turn one, we look at the commander and go, all right, commander, now what would you like to do? And you guys adjust and fight and adjust and fight as you go through the battle. And we block them off for 4 hours. I don't know that we've ever done one in less than 4 hours. Most of them run a little long. Nobody cares because nobody's paying attention to the clock. They're having too much fun. But we do a little after action report toward the end of it all. And sometimes that'll drag us past the 4 hours as well. So we do a bunch of these each summer, and they end up being a ton of fun for folks.
It sounds like fun. So,
oh yeah. This, last year we threw in an experiment where we tried a Reiswitz inspired legit, 1820 whatever Kriegspiel. Double blind, you know, a fully blind, like, you know, the study carols sort of propped up on the tables. And look, you can listen to enough podcasts and articles talking about the Kriegspiel from last year as much as you want. We did a ton of it was a lark, right? We did a free one on Wednesday night for people to sort of drop into, and we told them, look, we may reset in the middle of all this while we're trying to figure out 100% how we want to run these things. So we're not going to charge you to be here, but you're a bit of a guinea pig. And we had some folks kind of walk by on Wednesday and go, what the heck is that? I'm going to come back and check that out. We had so many people show up on Saturday night, Friday night or Saturday night, whatever night we were actually running that thing, that we had people show up with generic tokens. We had to kick them out to make room for all the ticket holders for the event. And we filled up a full Kriegspiel event. So we're doing at least two. I think we've got three of them on the schedule for this summer. So we've got three legit double-blind Kriegspiels we're setting up to run.
Oh, excellent.
So I don't know how many of them are opposite at the same time you're talking. But
yeah, it sounds like fun.
Yeah.
If it's not fun for me, it'll be fun for somebody else.
But if you want to do a little bit of Napoleonic battlefielding there in a legit blind Kriegspiel where all you can see is where your dudes are on the map and whatever your runner has told you is going on. So
this is a rare opportunity because commercial war games do not go in this direction.
No. And the thing is, one of the things we tell folks about the stuff we do at the conventions is, you know, look, you've got two great games in the bag right here. And there's absolutely nothing stopping you and your war game partner from throwing a couple of games on the table and digging out the beer and pretzels and putting on a football game in the background and pushing counters around for 12 hours one day. Totally cool. You can do that at home. It's tough for you to pull together the crew that you need to do one of the command post exercises at home because you need the coaches that actually know what they're teaching you. So you've got a certain level of expertise there you need for the coaches. You got to go find your willing participants. You need a half a dozen guys willing to jump in and be staff guys as well. You need a computer operator because you need somebody who's also going to program the op for as a part of all that. And you need 4 to 6 hours in which to make all that happen. That's not something you can pull off with your friends on a weekend in most places.
Absolutely not. This is closer to the professional experience, too, than just us recreational gamers.
Yeah, and that's how it all started. That was the genesis of it all, was trying to show folks what does a professional war game look like. If you're interested in what the professional wargaming world looks like and how it operates, this is how these guys actually use this. And at first, when James Sturt first started doing this, he was sort of talking about, these are the kinds of war games we would like to be able to use as a part of the curriculum at Command and General Staff College. And he realized the lecture was just a lousy way to impart that information. He said, well, what if I show them what one of these exercises looks like? And they've turned into one of the biggest hits that we've had year over year, that we get people that come to Origins just for those. And they'll be in every one of them that we can put them in.
Cool.
Yeah. It's a ton of, look, longtime listeners of the podcast or readers of the websites will this isn't anything new to you. You've heard this before. But every year we get new converts, and we've got a husband and wife team that when the first year they jumped into one of those, it was completely on a lark. They're like, yeah, we have no idea what we're doing. We just sort of, they were walking by and we wrangled them into it. And as boyfriend and girlfriend, they had a blast. They came back the next year. They were there for other things, but they specifically made time to come do one of those with us. The next year they came back and they had blocked off time to make sure they could get into two or three of these things. They had to work around a costume contest as well. But the first year they came to us, they were boyfriend, girlfriend. The next year they came back, they were engaged. The next year they came back, they were married. We're waiting to see if they show up this year with a kid.
Just as long as they don't go to being a divorced couple where they show up on opposite sides.
let's hope that doesn't happen. We have faith in them. They were pretty wonderful people. But yeah, it's like every year they came back, there was a new change of status with them.
Yeah.
But they were really sweet folks. They were really nice people. But that's what we get, is we get repeat offenders.
Yeah. Which is good. I mean, this shows
there are worse problems to have, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Having some subscribers there. So yeah. Current state of Line of Departure magazine.
Current state is that issue 82 just came out. I'm working on issue 83. Issue 82 is available. It should be in the hands of the subscribers all over the world right now. The status.
Well, it damn well better be by the time this comes out.
I put it out like 2 weeks ago.
Well, but from time of recording to time of release, we're about 10 days behind from when we record to when we release. So you'll be home in Pittsburgh by the time this hits the airwaves.
Right. And well, I put it out last month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it should be good and established and lining bird cages by the time you hear this.
There you go. There you go. And you're going to bring some copies with you this summer, right?
Oh, absolutely.
End up giving away to some people here and there.
Yes.
Shanghai some subscribers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it is a business.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. If you end up on the losing end of one of the games, we're going to make you subscribe.
So. Yes. Yeah.
That's your penance for losing your war games at our at the Armchair Dragoons command post area there.
Yes.
If you lose your game, you're forced to subscribe to Line of Departure.
Of course.
So.
Yeah, and if you lose really badly, then you have to write for me.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. What's the next game to hit your table when you get back home? Is it going to be one of these, or you got something else you're working on already?
There are a couple things that I was thinking of. One of them is I'm a larger booster for Kickstarter anymore, and I did get Dan Versen's Corsair Leader.
Okay.
Which looks very promising.
Okay.
I received that when it came out. That's probably on deck. I'm looking for that to appear in Line of Departure. I've already covered Hornet Leader Deluxe.
Yeah.
And I really like the work that Dan does. He's got himself a really good niche. He's made it his own.
Yeah, Dan's leader game engine there is pretty well established one. It's well known. It's obviously solo friendly. I mean, it's designed as a solo engine, which works well for a lot of folks. There's Corsair Leader, Hornet Leader. There's an Apache leader floating around out there. What else they have in the leader series for aircraft, right? We shall not discuss tank leader. Panzer leader, you know, that, not the Panzer leader one, but was it Tiger leader? There was a World War II one that was horribly broken when it was released. It shall go undiscussed at this point, but for the aircraft.
I think there's a B-17 leader, Fortress leader, there's, Israeli Air Force IAF leader.
Okay.
Phantom leader.
Yeah. Not all of which are still in print. No. I think some of these are out of print at this point. But
so I've got a good collection of Ursing games, and I really want to get into them more. I've got Fleet Admiral Nimitz.
Okay.
I've got Field General Napoleon.
Okay.
And I've also covered the Rommel game in Line of Departure.
Okay.
So I'm really quite taken with that. I do try to go for a balance inline of departure. So unless I'm having a postal issue, which is really concerned with one theme, one period, I try to balance things out as far as scale, complexity, and era goes.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got Corsair Leader waiting for you, and then who knows what's going to show up after that.
Got my Civil War games. I haven't covered Civil War in a while, so that's something I'm looking forward to.
All right. We got some Civil War stuff coming up.
Yes.
So the it's always interesting to ask folks, what's the very next thing that's going to hit your table? And then we get people come back around on a podcast a couple weeks later like, all right, so what's the last thing you played? And it's something completely different than what yes. it's supposed to be the next thing on their table. You know, the next thing on my table is supposed to be this. Well, what was the last thing you played? Well, I spent the last 2 weeks buried in Halo 3, you know, or something. You know, it's just something totally off the wall, completely different than what they intended to get to along the way.
Because line of departure readers should realize by this, I am an Age of Empires 2 junkie.
Yeah.
And that was covered last year in one of the issues. I've probably covered Age of Empires 2 three times at least. And that is my carpal tunnel game.
Yeah. Well, and it will be no surprise to anyone who's spent any time around any of the websites I've worked on that my severe addiction is Civ 5.
Yeah.
And in large part because my computer's not strong enough to run Civ 6. Once I upgrade the laptop, I'll probably end up completely in the tank for Civ 6, but Civ 5 is a bit of a masterpiece of gaming, the 4X gaming, as far as I'm concerned. And, yeah, I spend way too much time on that one.
Yeah.
So
I have actually hurt my wrist with Age of Empires.
Well.
And especially the new version.
Was it really Age of Empires that hurt your
wrist, Jim? Age of Empires 2.
Was it really Age of Empires 2? Was it really computer gaming that hurt your wrist, Jim?
It was computer gaming.
That's your story, and we're sticking to it.
Absolutely. But I can recommend the Age of Empires 2 as it's been updated on Steam with a whole lot more powers in it.
Okay.
So they put in people like the Ethiopians, the Malians, the Portuguese. Why weren't they in it in the first place? The Khmer, the Vietnamese, a whole lot of African and Asian powers. So you're not just playing the Teutons, the Celts, and the Spaniards all the time.
Yeah. Get away from just pure Europeans.
Yes.
And off into some other stuff.
Yeah. It's great to have your Saracen army go and beat up on the Cambodians for a change.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Something completely off. That was the GMT Games maneuver.
Yeah.
Is kind of fun that way. So I know Jeff. Jeff's a great dude. He's one of the cabbies. He's always at Origins. I saw Maneuver back in its pre-release days. So this was over a decade ago. Jeff taught me how to play at one of the local conventions right there in Columbus. And back when it was still wooden blocks with stickers on them for all the different units because it was still in playtesting. Really fun game. Love it to death. It's Age of Gunpowder stuff. So it's essentially Napoleonic era. But because it's a little more abstract, it goes Revolutionary War up through, up through Napoleon. But included in the box, you have the Germans, so the Prussians, right? The French, the English, the Spanish, the Russians. You've got the Americans, so you can do the Americans versus the French, Americans versus the British, however you want. The Ottomans are in the box. You can do the Americans versus the Ottomans if you wanted to. You can do the Austrians versus the Ottomans. You can do the British versus the Ottomans. So there's a variety of, again, it's ahistorical. You know, it's an 8x8 grid chess-like battlefield, and each side's got 8 units that you're maneuvering around. It's never been that perfectly cut and dried on a battlefield ever. But it's a fun beer and pretzels way to pass the time blowing people up. That's, you know, that's not yet another round of Ticket to Ride. So, but if you want to get a little ahistorical, there's one you can do it with.
Yes. But, I'm getting back. I am getting games on the table. Don't worry about that. I've got some freer time now because my work is now strictly online. I no longer commute to a job at all. I replaced that with another online teaching job. So I won't be spending money on gas. It's more money I can spend on games. And I won't be spending time on a commute. That is more time I can spend on games.
There you go.
Yeah.
And, you know, those students are online. They're just going to assume you're watching what they're doing anyway.
Yeah. funny thing is, most of my probably an outsized number of my students are active duty military.
Doing stuff online because that's where they can find it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Totally understand how that goes.
I've
done an online class or two here and there that I've taught, and it's the same thing. You get students, you know, everywhere from Miami to Seattle.
Yep. And I've got them on forward operating bases in Afghanistan. I've got Army drill sergeants, a growing number of them. The educators of the primary educators of the Army.
Yeah.
I've got people basically everywhere. You pick a time zone, I've had a student there.
Trying to build up those education credits for their promotion points.
Absolutely. Hey, and I'm happy to help.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing wrong with that at all.
Yeah.
At all. So one of these days you're going to have to give us a glimpse at some of the course notes for some of the courses you got going so people know what they're getting into if they sign up for a course there with the great Jim Werbeneff that is going to kick their butt.
Yeah. Yep, so. Most of what I teach is American government, so it reminds me when I teach stuff about our government that I am a specialist in the two worst things ever invented by man, politics and war.
Yeah, well.
So I'll have class notes on that.
Amazing how much one of those leads to the other.
Absolutely.
And then leads back to the other.
Yes.
And then leads back to the other, come to think of it. So.
Yeah.
In whatever direction you want to go. So. Yeah. It brings up an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Best war game you've played with a political component to it, in which the politics are an important part of the game, not just blowing each other up on the battlefield.
My favorite is Victory Games Pax Britannica.
Okay.
I have always wanted to teach an international relations course using that. I think it is it absolutely captures the power school of diplomacy. As written by Hans Morgenthau to start with, and yeah. It reflects that 19th century world very, very well.
So as that one is hopelessly out of print,
yes.
Any more contemporary ones that you might recommend for somebody looking for something that's got a comparable feel to it? Anything out there you've poked around at all?
Most of the ones I really like are out of print.
Are all out of print, yeah.
Especially from Victory Games. I think one that really captured a lot of the politics was the Vietnam game.
Yeah.
Where you have Vietnamese generals who are competent, or they can be loyal, but seldom are they both.
Yes.
Yeah, that you might have a loyal loser and a competent guy who's a closet commie.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that really impress me.
Yeah, it's amazing how many, even now, almost 40 years later, 35 years later, we look back at stuff from Victory Games and still, yeah, I'm not sure we're going to top that game on that. NATO Next War in Europe is still held up as one of the many, you know, at the theater level as one of the prime examples of a great Cold War Goes Hot in Europe game.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Vietnam being one of them, Pax Britannica. I mean, there's the Central America game.
Oh, yes.
There's, you know, if you go back through Victory Games catalog from 1987, how many games in there are still held up with great reverence today?
Yes.
And it's not like the designers have quit designing, right? Mark Herman's still a little busy these days.
Yeah.
but you know, Ambush, you know, is still considered one of the quintessential solo games out there. You know, if you wanted solitary ASL, just go play Ambush, except you can't find it. So,
yeah, unfortunate.
Yeah, so, you know, when you think about that, you know, go pull out a Victory Games catalog from 87, and how many of those are still treated by many of us old farts as the definitive game of blah.
Yeah. Those are the ones that I really... What the Victory Games they don't have are the ones that are pretty close to Grail games for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, to my mind, that in large part, that was the high point of commercial wargaming. You had all the strength of SBI with all the strength of Avalon Hill in one efficient package.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as has been pointed out plenty of times on this and other podcasts... It's not like we're living in the dark ages of wargaming.
No.
We are fortunate to have some ridiculously talented dudes cranking out games like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We've got, you know, Mark Herman has now retired from his position at Booz Allen and has gone almost exclusively to war game design. And, you know, Volko's still working for the CIA, but he's still churning out games like crazy. Brian Train's still churning out stuff. You know, who is it that does the 40X series from GMT? Mark Simonich.
I'm
totally going to mispronounce the name. Sorry, Mark. Yeah. If you're listening, I apologize.
Yeah.
But we've got
Take it from somebody like me who has an even more unpronounceable name.
Dude. Yeah. Seriously, my last name is Guillory.
That one's easy.
I used to live down the street from Gilroy, California.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, we've got all the commands and colors permutations out there. I mean, we are not short on great games to play. Mm-hmm. And yet, even folks that were, you know, 10 when those victory games things were coming out still look back at them and go, man, I love that game. They've had a chance to play because we kept them around for so long. That those still become great games. And again, like the Coin series of games are great games.
Oh, yes.
Some fantastic lessons to be learned in those games. You couldn't have sold those games in 1987.
No.
But, you know, they're still, like you said, some of those games, especially from Victory, are still, you know, that those are the grail games for people, and not just because of their collectability, but because they want to play them.
Absolutely.
So
I've practically worn out my copy of Vietnam.
Yeah.
And as for current games that have political aspects that I really, really like, Andy and Abyss from the Coin series is pretty close to the top. It is on an unusual topic, but it's still one they do TV about, like Narcos.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that game.
Yeah, Andy and Abyss is... All of the Coin games have their own unique twist to them. All of them are set up as four players with loosely two sides to them. Andy and Abyss is interesting because you've got the two obvious big brothers on each side, and then you've got a pair of attack dogs on either side. It's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
You've got two guys that are both sort of struggling to want to actually govern the country, and two agents of chaos that just want to blow shit up.
Yes.
And it makes for an interesting contrast, not just between the two sides in the game, but also between the two allies on each side.
Yes.
I agree with you. I think the Coin games are definitely an interesting approach to power dynamics in modern war game. And in fact, this summer at Origins, circle back around to Origins, we're pulling a distant plane back out, and we're gonna try the team wargaming again with that one.
Oh, excellent.
For just the preview for folks to get a sense of what's coming up with that one. And maybe we'll draft you into one of these as well. What we set up for a distant plane. So for folks not as familiar with the Coin system, it's very high level, very abstract. You're not moving battalions around with a CRT. You're moving forces and bases in a very abstract way around the map. And you've got some cards that dictate what's happening each turn. They specify a turn order. They specify some sort of special event that is happening. So what we'll do, and depending on what happened the previous turn, we'll change the order of action this turn, in terms of who's doing what and what resources you can use, and the resources you use to do things take away eventual victory points within the game. What we do for a distant plane, there are four factions in there. There's the NATO allied faction, there's the Afghan national government, there's the Taliban, and there's the warlords. And the warlords are sort of this middle faction in there that are a little tough to play. I love playing the warlords when I play distant plane, because you are kind of agents of chaos a little bit. If the warlords really piss somebody off, they're going to get stomped off the board in a heartbeat. But they're not annoying enough that you really want that as one of the other players, you really need to expend a lot of energy to stomp them off the board. Sort of your best bet is to poke at everybody else and hope everybody else loses and you win by default. What we do for the team game, assuming we have at least two players for each of the four factions, we need at least eight people to pull this off. You have a military person and a diplomatic person for each of the roles, except the warlords. I'll get back to those guys in a second. So what we do is we pull the political leadership for each of the factions off to the side. We pull out that turns card, and we make you have to make a quick decision as to if you're the first actor in there, are you going to use a special event, or are you going to do some other action on the map? And we sort of force people to make a political decision fairly quickly. We do give them a little bit of time to cut side deals and whatever other political shenanigans they want to do. And the political guys always have the opportunity to talk to each other away from the table at any point in the game. They can always go have a conversation. You can always have secret talks with the Taliban if you want. That's totally fine. Once they've got the turn order and the effects and whatever else specified, whatever they think they're going to do, whatever deals they've cut, hey, I need you to reinforce this in order for me to go attack that, whatever it may be, then the political guy and his military counterpart go spend a second or two on the side of the map, and the political guy's got just a couple of minutes, because we gotta keep the game moving,
of course,
to specify to the military guy, these are your orders for this turn. Political guys walk away from the map, and the military guys have to execute. Mm-hmm. And have to make everything happen. So you've got to get pretty good about handing off orders and trusting your dude to execute what you think he's supposed to execute. The political guys realize very fast you can't micromanage everything. The military guys understand you can't wait for instructions for everything. At some point, you just got to do stuff. And the military guys don't get to talk to each other. They're just doing stuff on the map. If you want to cut a side deal, you've got to tell your politician to go talk to their politician. So we've put some roles on people. We've created some separation so that field commander isn't cutting a ton of local diplomacy, because that local diplomacy doesn't exist in a distant plane. It's replicated by some specific card events. The high level stuff happens between the politicians away from the map. Now, the warlords are the unusual case. As long as we've got at least two dudes playing the warlords, what we do is the warlords will play both the political and diplomatic role. Mm-hmm. But we swap them out each turn.
Ooh.
So
That's interesting.
Because the warlords are an amalgamation of lots of other people, as a whole, they don't really represent some. Now, we let them collaborate some in between.
Yeah.
Hey, try to do this. But when you're in charge of the warlords that turn, if you get a target of opportunity come up, you grab it and run with it. Like, you don't have to ask permission. And so the warlords can run around and talk to whoever, and especially if it's their turn, they go cut a deal with somebody, and they're the military dude on the map who gets to immediately execute it as well. The trick to all of that is the next dude coming in right behind him that tags out for the next turn may end up stabbing you in the back because he didn't know anything about the deal because they didn't get a chance to talk about it between turns. So it ends up, we do it kind of quickly. We seed the deck a little bit. We do ahead of time pull some of the major events out of the deck. So there's not a ton of minor events where it's sort of, all right, everybody got to get to catch a breath and regroup this turn. We don't give you that chance.
Yeah.
We want to keep the action moving as quickly as possible in this game to keep everybody engaged and to give people big stuff to talk about. But it becomes a really interesting way to sort of force people to approach the game, approach the scenario and the situation. We have a lot of fun with it.
It sounds like fun, and the idea of having the warlords play like this also makes up for the lack of material strength, gives them more flexibility, makes them a little more dangerous, and is a bit of a force multiplier, but at the same time can also carry dangers for that side.
And again, part of it is to try and replicate, because the warlords are an amalgamation of a lot of loosely, you know, it's guys that are only a collective unit in that they are opposed to everybody else on the map, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily working together at any point in time. And a way to replicate that is to have completely different people in charge of each turn. So,
and at the same time with the warlords, you could expect them, some of their biggest rivals would be each other. And
yes.
They would be likely to stab each other in the back.
Yep. And, you know, of course, the allies and the Afghan national player have to talk to each other all the time because the ANA needs, the only way they get resources to execute actions is to get them from the allied player. The allied player is the logistical support for the ANA. The flip side of it is the ANA has a ton more forces than the allies. If the allies want to get some stuff done, they've got to use the ANA to do it. And yet they're both competing for victory points on the same map. So it's what's great about the game, like, at some point you declare a victor just based on the points of the game.
Yeah.
But I've never seen a game of a distant plane play to completion in which everybody kind of looked at the map afterwards and go, yeah, that one's going to take over. That one's clearly going to – you hit a cutoff point at which you sort of count the points and say, yeah, you won the game. But it's obvious nobody's won the war.
Yeah.
And I think that's been obvious since – Alexander rolled into Afghanistan.
I may have said this on the last
in the BCs.
I may have said this on the last podcast, but Afghanistan is the country that drove Alexander to drink, and the game seems to capture it in that regard. That and it also captures something too from this perspective. There's an old thing that a British political officer in the 19th century said about Afghanistan. He said the Afghans will never do what you want and never do what you expect.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, I
start over.
Yeah. Unlikely. And yeah.
Although they try.
Yes, they seem to really enjoy it. You would think they'd figure it out at some point.
I kill, therefore I am.
The only thing they enjoy more than killing each other is killing outsiders. So.
Yeah.
Who knows? Yeah. The Duffel blog has some fun with Afghanistan every year, every now and then. You know, the upcoming season of Afghanistan the War promises to be the coolest yet.
Yes. So. Between Duffel blog and Doctrine Man, that keeps me sane.
Yes. Yes, both quite amusing.
Yeah.
Well, look, we've managed to wrangle an hour of podcast recording out of all of this, although we may end up tweaking it down slightly. I'm hoping we don't have too much ambient noise as to make this too unlistenable, but even if we did, look, by the time we're talking about it now, an hour into this, it's too late now.
Yeah.
I wish we could have Scott join us. One of these days we'll actually get him on here. You know what would be cool is one of these days we need to, like, make plans to link up at a couple of, if not you, some other locals at some of the game stores around the rest of the U.S. and let's go record some on-location podcasts.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
In D.C., in Pittsburgh, in Columbus. Yeah. Well, Columbus, we're going to sort of kind of do it because of Origins.
Yeah.
But we've got the Soldiery in Columbus. Maybe we set up shop there sometime.
Yeah.
One of these days we'll get down to Baton Rouge and we'll get some recording done down there with whoever's available. Go over to the World War II Museum in New Orleans. Maybe do one from there. So we gotta take this show on the road and actually do some stuff at different war game stores around the country because, yeah, we show Scott a lot of love here, but he's not the only great war game store out there. He's just the one I have in my backyard.
The one that I really like in Pittsburgh in the Oakland District near University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon, Phantom of the Attic.
There you go.
And if war games aren't nerdy enough for you, he's also a comic book vendor.
Yeah.
It's a terrific place. I've done playtesting there for Turning Point Simulations. Jeff is a great guy. If you're in Pittsburgh, I hope that you support him. He's got a really good store.
Well, if I make it up to Pittsburgh one of these days, then maybe we'll set up shop in there and do a recording from there sometime. So
I'm up.
Yeah, well,
I'm up for it.
I'm sure we know where to find you.
Yes.
All right. We appreciate you listening to the latest episode here. I was about to say issue, but these are more episodes of Mentioned in Dispatches. And okay, the countdown is on. By the time you're hearing this, you're under 60 days to get your butt to Origins. So come see us. Come war game with us. Come have some fun in Columbus this summer. Although if not, we are also planning to hit both Mace in November and Buckeye Game Fest in October, I think it is. So Armchair Dragoons are going to be on the road beyond just Origins. And we look forward to seeing you guys there as well.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Brian. It was fun.
All right.